Have you ever wondered how elected officials make a living in Charlotte? Or where are the monuments to Charlotte's role in the American Revolution? Vote for the question you'd like us to answer in the next episode of the FAQ City Podcast by going to WFAE.org. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On Sunday night, a riot in a South Carolina prison resulted in the deaths of seven inmates. It was yet another example of the violent conditions faced by inmates and their guards at prisons around the country. North Carolina has its own problems. Two reporters from the Charlotte Observer focused extensively on those problems, particularly on Lanesboro, which has experienced violence and corruption for years. Dozens of officers and inmates have been attacked there since it opened in January 2004, but problems in our prisons aren't exclusive to Lanesboro. Staff shortages have been on the rise state system-wide, leading to higher overtime costs and prison officers who are overworked. This hour, we hear about the problems at our prisons, why they're happening, and what the state is trying to do to address them. And we begin with Kenneth Lassiter. He is the director of prisons for the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. He joins us by phone. Good morning. Welcome. We're going to be talking to those two reporters who wrote this extensive series on the prisons in the Charlotte Observer later on in the program. But that series talks about personnel shortages, the death of a guard, the dangers of both guards and prisoners. The series told of officers sleeping on the job because many are overworked with overtime, and about contraband finding its way into the prisons through various means, including by prison personnel. And I'm assuming that you are familiar with that series. Was there anything that you disagree with that surprised you that you think they got wrong?
I think there's a host of things that I could say, I won't say was gotten wrong, but taking total out of contents of what our entire system is made of, I would first like to say that we have about 17,000 employees throughout this DPS prisons, adult corrections area. And of those, they're professionals, and they day in and day out put their lives on the line for a very dangerous profession. So any light about what we do and why we do it, I think, is welcome. Do we disagree with some of the contents of some of the story? Just a little, not drastic differences. But we've cooperated with the reporters and have a good dialogue with them going forward as to some of the things that could be brought to light that maybe the public can be made aware of how dangerous it is to our facilities, and come up with solutions to help us hire and maintain some employees.
The Observer's articles say that they uncovered, and this is a quote, a hidden world of drugs, sex, and gang violence that thrives inside the state's prisons. Is that hidden to prison officials, or were you aware of it, and would you disagree with that characterization?
I disagree with the characterization. Corrections has been charged with housing, provide testing, rehabilitating the worst of the worst of society. So if someone has a criminal enterprise on the street, by them coming to prison, it won't just stop. They won't just to try to continue that criminal enterprise. And so it's through security efforts and through our training and through us doing some rehabilitative reform efforts that we change that person's behavior. But initially, anyone coming to prison is going to try to continue with the enterprise. Have we had inappropriate acts by staff over the years, like any other profession? Yes, I will say it. And we hold them to the highest standard, and we prosecute when we can, and we separate every time we can. And so to say it was hidden, I'm not sure who was doing the hiding, based on your question.
Okay. Your predecessor, George Solomon, I believe he's your predecessor, who recently retired as director of prison, said it would be naive for him to have said that he didn't have corrupt staff in every prison. Why are they difficult to ferret out?
And I would disagree with Mr. Solomon a little bit.
Mr. Lassiter, you're breaking up. If you could find a steady place, maybe we can continue this conversation. Try now.
Here, I didn't move. I'm in the same spot. Can you hear me?
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I got you now. Go ahead. That's all right. Go ahead.
Mr. Solomon, I was one of his deputies. I would disagree slightly with every prison. Is there an opportunity anytime human interaction happened that someone could be corrupted? Yes. And so I wouldn't say it happens in every prison. I would say that the difficulty is that we are trying to employ people in this dangerous environment. And prior to some of the reforms we've made, we were actually sending people a little to training a little bit late. So we've changed some things, and now all employees go to basic training before they have interaction with inmates. That gives us the ability to further train and enhance the training that they're getting as it relates to some of the issues that are unlike any other profession that are faced by correctional officers when they walk in the door as it relates to inmates trying to manipulate them to do something that is against the rules and against the law.
Prisons are dangerous, particularly high-security prisons. They're dangerous places because you're housing the most dangerous, allegedly the most dangerous among us, and so that makes for a dangerous job prospect for guards and personnel and staff. And there are occasional problems at prisons across the country. How would you assess the safety of our prisons, both for the inmates and for the personnel, the staff who operate the prisons, and how would you compare that level of safety to other state prisons?
A comparison would be hard to do because each system is totally different. And some people would ask, how is the system different? The difference based on, one, the state makeup, the demographics of who's employed, unemployment, as relates to if you have a booming economy, then it's much harder to get employees and in the correctional profession. The image of how they're received in the different states. In some states, unlike ours, correctional officers are part of the law enforcement chain, so they have the benefits that come with being in law enforcement. Those contribute to what type of system you have. As relates to the safety across the board, it is inherent that everyone knows that inside of a correctional facility, regardless if it's in Maine, North Carolina, South Carolina, or California, it is a dangerous environment. And so, therefore, there's an element of danger that will be there. We try to mitigate that danger as much as possible through policy procedures, through physical structure, through training, but there's always an inherent danger to working in this environment.
In June, I think it was June of last year, the Governor's Crime Commission asked your division to research best practices in prison management and provide recommendations for change. I would imagine that those recommendations are being formulated or have been and are being discussed. Did you uncover anything, any best practices that you weren't doing that you want to adopt going forward?
Yeah, well, there's a few recommendations from the Governor of Crimes Commission that we had already began to adopt as part of prisons management, and this was under the watch of Mr. Solomon and leading up to now. We've always been in a reform mode or remissioning mode where we're actually evaluating our facilities and looking at best practices and how do we use the facility based on what it can do for the entire system, not just what it can do for an isolated population. And so in part of that, some of the things we were looking at in reference to training was an ongoing initiative. And so we pushed that forward, and that's how we was able to get the training part in the first week. So we've been looking at that for a couple of years. A few more recommendations about custody and security issues, those around pet frisk search, a couple of those things we implemented following the recommendations from the Governor Crimes Commission.
One of the articles in the Observer reported that in some cases the guards were more dangerous than the criminals to each other. Does that speak to inadequate screening of employees when they're hired? They're being underpaid, so they have to resort to other ways of making money, or some other problem that's difficult to separate from the kind of work that these people do as prison guards?
Well, I would take offense to the word guard. I think that's those people that come in and act like guards, those are the ones that are not part of the profession, the criminal justice family, correctional officers. And so there's an element, a very small percentage, less than 0.8% of the total body of employees we have get involved with some criminal activity with inmates. And so when we make a brushstroke that all correctional officers are engaged in such activity, that's one of the things we took offense with the article. Again, we publicly say, and I've been in this business now for almost 29 years and a few more weeks, there are people that come into this profession that have no business in this profession, and unfortunately, the way they get weeded out is by an inmate corrupting them to do something for an inmate. And so there is an element, and with us bringing in so many staff that we bring in, you know, year in and year out because of turnover, then you do have a possibility for someone that should never be in this environment being part of taking on this profession, just like any other profession.
Aren't they screened up? One of the allegations made is that there's not enough background checks. You don't screen, for instance, their Facebook profiles to see, look for signs of trouble in would-be hires, rather. And officers are rarely asked to turn out their pockets on their way into work or their way out of work. So that facilitates them being able to bring in cell phones and drugs and other contraband. Do you disagree with that?
I think that the screening process that we have is a validated screening process, and it's used by other government agencies. So I think there is an element in that, how to improve that process through testing and make sure you have the right applicant in the pool. So we're working on that. As relates to best practices, one of the things we did begin to do is pet first search entering our prisons. And so that facilitated us actually touching staff and them actually being searched as they come to and from work. But the other part of this is that staff introducing contraband is not the only way contraband is introduced into a facility. It's introduced through visitation, through mail, through throwovers. So we're doing everything we can to prevent any effort of contraband entering the facility, not just through our staff. Because, again, that percentage of staff that will introduce contraband is very minute compared to how other ways it can get inside a facility.
Evidently, one of the challenges that you face and that is faced by prisons all over the country is attracting and retaining prison personnel, particularly the officers who interface directly with the inmates. It's happening all over the country. Why? What are the factors that go into that?
I think the economy plays a role with that. It's not just corrections. I mentioned earlier about us not being recognized as law enforcement, but and some, when we are recognized, it's in the employment process. And some states require that you must work in a prison prior to, you know, going to be a street cop, and some don't. So there's various ways to manage that. But in most situations, it's based on the economy. Prisons and law enforcement do very well when the economy is not doing that well because people are looking for employment. But when the economy is humming and doing very well, then it's less because of the danger, people choose not to go into these professions.
And evidently, the pay is not very good for these officers. I think it's, what, $38,000 a year, which is $8,000 a year below the national average. And as you said, when the economy is good, there are other job opportunities, and they take them. And that has led to staff shortages, which then leads to greater overtime for those people who do take those jobs and stay in those jobs, which leads to fatigue. How big a problem is all of this?
Overtime is an issue because we're a 12.25 state, meaning our staff are charged to work the majority of 12.25 shifts, and that's a long time to be at work and engaged in this dangerous environment. You need to be alert. And then so when you have to work overtime, then that compounds the amount of frustration and fatigue setting in. So we take several measures to try to do things to reduce overtime, but we're mandated to have safe environments, and so we have to have post-field, and that's how we fill them is with overtime. So we're doing everything we can in the recruiting part to try to alleviate that. But, yes, the frustration is that fact that we can't retain and recruit enough people, therefore to reduce overtime is a frustration on our part.
The Observer says the staff shortages are critically dangerous. Would you use those words?
No. Right now we are about, this morning when I look, I think we're right at 17% vacancy rate across the entire state. And with that number being at 17%, that's greater than what we would want it to be by far. But it gives us the ability, because we have isolated places where the rate is very high, as to where we can move a particular inmate if we need to alleviate a facility from operating in a critical condition. So I would say we're at a point where, yes, we need to pay as much attention as we're paying. To use the word critical, that's their word. I wouldn't use it in describing where we are.
I have about 15 seconds left. How confident are you that the changes that you're in the process of making and that you're talking about will adequately address some of the problems that were reported on in that Observer series?
I'm enthusiastic about where we're going. I think with the support of the governor's office and the legislators, Secretary Hooks and Chief Secretary Young have put us in an environment where we can continue to move forward and continue to progress. So I'm optimistic that where we're going is the right place be going. But again, this is a large ship, so it takes time to turn the ship, and that's what the public may be aware of.
Kenneth Lassiter is Director of Prisons with the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. Thank you for your time. When we come back, we'll talk to the two people who wrote these articles.
Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. Do you have 5 minutes to spare? If you do, then we'd love for you to take our Charlotte Talks listener survey. Super quick, super important for us, and you can find it right now on WFAE.org. We appreciate the feedback. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Many of the problems in our prisons came to light because of an extensive series published in the Charlotte Observer focusing on Lanesboro Correctional Institution, which is described in those articles as one of North Carolina's most dangerous and understaffed prisons. Lanesboro is a maximum security facility about 45 miles southeast of Charlotte, which will soon be getting a new name, Anson Correctional Institution, if it hasn't already. And here to further our discussion of problems in our prisons and to share some of what they found are the two reporters who wrote that investigative series, Ames Alexander and Gavin Off. Both are with the Charlotte Observer and both are with us in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome back.
How you doing, Mike?
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. They are joined here by Elizabeth Forbes, who is the director of NCCure. Their main priority is to educate and provide resources to reform criminal justice and to improve the conditions of confinement for people incarcerated throughout the state. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
And as we go through the rest of the program, you can join our conversation. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. You can even watch this on Facebook Live. Let me begin with Ames Alexander and Gavin Off. Was it your idea or your editor's idea to investigate the prison conditions around North Carolina?
I guess it was kind of our idea. I first became interested in the prisons back in 2009 when I got an email from the sister of an inmate at Lanesboro who said that her brother had been horribly abused there. And when I looked into it, it turned out that what had happened is that officers at the prison had sprayed this burning hot chemical called pepper spray up and down his naked body. And that story led to other tips and to other stories. And so it turned out that inmates were regularly attacking officers. Officers were bringing in drugs and other contraband to inmates. And there was the prison's top official was even indicted for obstruction of justice. Some years later, got a tip from some folks who saw a prison surveillance video that was taken at Lanesboro in the hours after an inmate was murdered there. And what that surveillance video showed is that a high-ranking manager at Lanesboro was making a keep-quiet gesture to the killer. And then several months later, the SBI and prison officials found a bag of bloody shanks hidden above the ceiling tiles of that manager's office. So this raised a lot of interesting questions, and at that point, Gavin and Elizabeth Leland and I sort of dug in looking at not only abuses and corruption at Lanesboro, but across the system.
So I want to go back to that incident with the pepper spray. What was the reason for the guards, in their words or after the investigation uncovered it, what was the reason for their using that? What was the inmate engaging in that caused them to have to feel that they should use that?
So it was late at night, and this inmate was housed next to another inmate who was threatening his life. And so this inmate was having a panic attack. And he was banging on the cell doors asking to be moved. And officers came to his cell. There was a verbal confrontation. They pepper sprayed him. They're supposed to take him to the shower to wash off this burning chemical. They took him to the shower, and he took off his clothes. And at that point, they started spraying pepper spray up and down his naked body. And allegedly, they did not even let him go to the nurse after that for hours. So
this sounds like abuse and not a deterrent. It sounds like just a vindictive, mean-spirited thing. Is that how you would characterize it?
Yes, and he later won a settlement from the state.
Elizabeth, I mean, this is one of the things that your organization does to ensure the safety of prisoners in the prison, to make sure that they're safe from guards or not mistreated by prison officials. Is that an outlier incident, or is this something that if we knew about what goes on, we'd know that it goes on all the time?
Well, I'm not so sure that we can ensure the safety of people that are incarcerated in North Carolina, but certainly we advocate
That's
for their well-being.
That's a pretty big charge.
Yes, and the individual that Ames was referring to has mental health disorders. So many times we find that people with such disorders act out.
But do you know of other incidences that are similar to this where guards
Absolutely.
Have abused prisoners? Does it happen frequently? Does it happen in all of the prisons? Does it happen only with a few bad apple guards? How would you describe the problem?
Well, It's a complex problem to begin with. But I can describe it this way from where we stand, okay, in working with families of people incarcerated, working with inmates, and working with prison staff alike. People with mental health issues, if that's what you're referring to specifically.
Actually, I'm actually referring to the guards and mistreating or taking measures that are not warranted to discipline or punish or whatever, however you want to describe it.
Well, then you're referring to an abusive situation?
Yes. Okay. How often does that happen?
I think it probably happens more often than we would like. I think it happens more often than we are made aware of, simply because it's a prison system. The people within the system, employees, are asked to be quiet. I believe that in some instances they also have to sign waivers where they can't speak about issues that happen inside the prison system. As I said, it's a complex situation on the inside. I think that many officers lack the training. Many officers slip through the gates without proper screening, in difference to what your first guest explained. And I think that when officers, if you will, use tactics of abuse, that often a blind eye is turned because of such a shortage of staff. So they have to replace that person. If they get rid of that person, they have to replace them.
Gavin, this became a series. I'm not sure how many articles there were in a series, but I would think there's about 10 or so in the series of reports that you and Ames wrote. What really got your attention as you investigated, as you wrote? What stood out to you?
One of the big things that jumped out to me was the consistency of the stories that the inmates and the officers told us. It didn't matter if it was a prison on the East Coast or in the mountains. They all talked about the culture where top officials would largely look the other way for a lot of the corruption. They all talked about officers who would bring in contraband and how much specifically that contraband was sold to or sold for in prisons. They all talked about the same hiding places for contraband and the same schemes about having sex between officers and inmates. The consistency of their stories was amazing.
Why would they tell you these things? Are these people who claim not to engage in these activities themselves but are reporting on others engaging in this activity?
Inmates essentially bragged to us about
the inmates
and officers.
Well, when we talk about inmates, and this goes to Elizabeth's comment previously to this and to obviously you're talking to inmates. These people are criminals. How do you verify what they're saying?
Exactly. Ames may be able to jump in here, but I think we talked to give or take 80 inmates or corresponded with 80 inmates and 65 officers. And what we would hear from one person never made it into the paper. What we hear from 5, 8, 10 people made it into the paper.
So you're getting corroboration from both sides.
And public documents, dismissal letters, grievances, etc.
You wrote, and this is a quote that I posed to the director of prisons a moment ago, you uncovered a, quote, hidden world of drugs, sex, and gang violence that thrives inside the state's prisons. Before I ask you how bad it all is, let me ask you about what he said, the director of prisons, Kenneth Lassiter, that he took issue with the word hidden. What did you mean by the word hidden?
Well, prisons are closed societies. They don't put out press releases every time somebody's assaulted or somebody brings in drugs to officers. You know, it's not easy to find out this stuff. And it's not until, you know, Gavin and I started talking with dozens of inmates and officers that we were able to corroborate a lot of what was going on.
Mm-hmm. So the quote, hidden world of drug, sex, gang violence that thrives inside our state's prisons. How bad is it? How bad is the gang violence?
It's bad. I mean, we're told on a daily basis through letters that there are certain gangs that run North Carolina's prisons, and the officers know it, and they'll sort of, I don't want to say let the gangs do what they want to do, but they'll work with the gangs to make sure there's peace in the prison.
It's difficult to gauge the safety of a prison. It seems to me to be a pretty dangerous place because of who is housed there, Elizabeth. But how would you describe the conditions in our state's prisons? And where does the danger come from? Is it from the inmates or the guards or a combination of the two?
Well, first of all, we need to realize that there are three modes of custody. There's your minimum custody,
right,
the way our inmates are housed in North Carolina. So you have minimum, you have medium, and you have maximum.
Okay.
Very rarely, I mean, since 2007, when NCCure was founded, we've probably collected about 8,000 letters since that time from prisoners. Very rarely do we receive communication from closed custody, unless, and because of our sentencing guidelines, you could have a person with a mental health disorder that committed a low-level crime, but because of the accumulation of all his crimes, because he's acting out, he has behavioral issues, he can end up, okay, with a felony C and end up in a closed prison.
And again, closed is a maximum security.
Closed is maximum. So in that environment, it is very much a different world than the environment that you might see in a minimum custody.
So when you put somebody who has mental health issues and who acts out, as you say, is subject to outbursts and are probably difficult to physically control, should they be in that environment? Should they be mixed in with hardened criminals who actually are not crazy but do crazy things, I suppose? Should they be there or should they be housed someplace else? And if you took them out of that environment, would that increase the safety of maximum security prisons? Where I think, and Lanesboro is one of those maximum security prisons, and that's where the problem seemed to lie.
Well, first of all, I don't think it would create the safety of a maximum security prison. But taking a mentally ill person out of a maximum security prison certainly will increase their safety. They're vulnerable, and they are subject to being abused, and they are abused.
So you receive letters not only from family members but from people who are incarcerated.
And that is correct.
And that's how you get a lot of your inside information, and I guess you check it out before you act on it. But how does what you hear and have heard in those letters compare with what Ames and Gavin have written about?
Well, for the most part, I'd say they were pretty much in line.
Okay. You spoke to guards about how they feel in terms of safety. Are how many of them are actually afraid?
I think a lot of them are afraid.
Is that natural? Would that not be a natural human instinct to be afraid?
It is, exactly. But when you're asked to not only work your 12-hour shift to stay on for another 4 hours, in a maximum security prison that is already short-staffed, then that just makes the dangers all that much more.
And Ames, as I said, it's a natural thing to be afraid if you're around hardened criminals who have committed murder and other acts of violence. But one of the things that the two of you wrote in your story was that some of the guards are more afraid of the other guards than they are of the inmates. How unusual is that? Is that particular to North Carolina, or?
It's a good question. Gavin and I have not done a lot of reporting outside North Carolina. I suspect it's true in other systems, but when you think about it, most of the officers are honest and doing the right thing, but it doesn't take many corrupt ones to really spoil the whole system.
Well, if you talk to these officers, and you did, and some of them said they talked openly about contraband, about sex, about other things going on in the prison, why don't they talk to prison higher-ups and ferret these people out?
Fear.
Fear of what? If you're gone.
They fear retaliation. They fear losing their jobs. They fear that it's going to many officers tell us that the system does not encourage people to speak out.
And that's going back to what you said earlier, is because they're already having trouble attracting people, and if they lose people, it's going to be even worse. We'll talk about the overtime situation and what that leads to. It's going to be worse for that. How do inmates, Elizabeth, view the guards? The ones that you talk to and the families that you talk to.
Right. Well, you know, we do see a difference in inmates, their relationship with guards and how they view them depending on, again, the custody level. So perhaps inmates that are in minimum custody, there seems to be more respect. I don't want to say a closer relationship, but at least a platonic relationship.
More respect from the guards toward the inmates?
More respect for the guards.
For the guards, okay.
Yes, there seems to be much more respect.
How much of that is due to the fact that the inmates in those minimum security situations are different from the people in the maximum security situations? They're probably not quite as antisocial, if that's the right word to use.
Well, you have inmates in minimum that are there for misdemeanors. They may only be there for a year,
right,
if that. And then you have inmates that have really gone through the system. If they haven't learned by now, mm-hmm, they never will. Most of them have learned. And by the time they get to minimum, they just want to do their time and go home. You know, they don't want any trouble.
Yeah. And you report that family members are often intimidated by correctional staff and frustrated with their inability to obtain information about their loved one who's incarcerated, and they fear retaliation against their incarcerated loved one if they complain. Are those fears directed at guards or at administrative personnel, and are they justified?
Well, they are justified, but look, the prison's job is security, okay? And, you know, it's complex to explain, but this system, unless it takes a cultural change, a paradigm shift in the way they're doing things, it's going to be business as usual. And it's just a very tough situation inside.
You reported in one of your articles that in some cases the guards are more dangerous than the criminals to each other. I want to come back after the break and talk a little bit about that, a little bit more about that, because that seems to be a pretty striking statement there. Ames Alexander and Gavin Off are with us. They're two reporters who reported on the prison series that appeared recently in the Charlotte Observer. And Elizabeth Forbes is director of NC Cure. They advocate for inmates and their families. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the state of North Carolina's prisons as the result of a series that appeared recently in the Charlotte Observer that you can read on their website at charlotteobserver.com. Ames Alexander and Gavin Off are with us. They are the two principal reporters who dealt with this story over its 10 or 12 or 13 or how many episodes there were. And Elizabeth Forbes is here, director of NC Cure. We talked earlier to Kenneth Lasseter, who's director of prisons, and we were talking about guards and the kind of people they are able to hire, and you report in your stories that in some cases the guards are more dangerous than the criminals. Do you think he feels that way? From what he said, I don't believe he does.
I don't presume to know exactly what he's thinking, but I do think that a lot of the law-abiding officers think that the corrupt officers are making a dangerous situation a lot more so. The corrupt officers are bringing in drugs. They're often providing inmates weapons. They're providing them cell phones, which in essence can be weapons themselves. And they can foster this really toxic atmosphere that can lead to warfare inside prisons.
Yeah. So how these, you found at least 8 officers at Lanesboro were caught bringing in these items, drugs, cell phones, tobacco, from 2013 to 2017. I take it, maybe you don't know, but you can tell me if you do or don't. Is this going on everywhere?
It is. Actually, following our series, the legislators asked DPS to look into this specific example, and what they found was 57 officers have been fired and charged with committing crimes while on the job between 2013 and 2017. We actually found a few more, but what that showed is that they were happening all around the state, not at every prison, but at dozens of prisons.
So who's paying for the items? you can't. Cell phones aren't free. Tobacco isn't. None of these things are free. The drugs certainly aren't free. So who's paying for this? Is it the inmates or is it somebody outside the prison?
I think it's both. Surprisingly, inmates. We've talked to them.
Where do they get the money?
Through visitation, through officers bringing it in. A lot of times they'll use MoneyGrams, wire services, family members who will physically drop off cash to the officer or his or her husband or wife.
Because each prisoner has an account, correct, with the prison to buy toiletries and incidentals mm-hmm. and things like that. You're this is way more than that, and it's coming in under the table, so
exactly.
they have more to
yeah.
deal with. Why do the guards do this? Is it because they're underpaid and they need more money? Is it because they're trying to insulate themselves? If you're a supplier of wanted materials, if there's a riot or an attack, you're not going to be attacked because you're the guy who brings stuff to them. What's the fundamental reason for them doing this?
There are a few things, but I think a fundamental thing for a lot of the officers is money. I mean, they are not paid well, and they can double or triple their salaries through bringing in contraband. They can make a lot of money by bringing in drugs and cell phones. And there are other dynamics involved, too. I mean, officers are often afraid of these inmates, and sometimes officers are talked into going along to get along, and so I think that plays a yeah. role, too.
You can buy a cheap flip phone at Walmart for maybe $20, $25 and sell it inside a prison for hundreds of dollars.
Why don't they jam the signals of cell phones in prisons?
Good question. I think they're looking into that. I may be wrong, but
it might be illegal under the FCC.
Exactly, because I think you would block other signals from homes and businesses around
and,
the prisons.
And jamming a cell phone signal so that the inmates cannot use their illegal cell phones, could that jeopardize communications among personnel?
Yeah, good question. Or emergency officials on the outside.
Okay. As I mentioned to the prison director, as I understand it through your reports, the average guard salary is about $38,000 a year. That's below the national average by about $8,000. But you reported that one officer who took home $45,000 did so because of overtime. Others work second jobs because they don't make enough to support their families. How much more are those on the take bringing home? Do we know?
We don't. I mean, it's thousands of dollars.
I mean, could it be $100,000? Could it be just a little bit more than the $45,000 they're making in overtime?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'd hate to guess.
We have talked to inmates who described incredibly lucrative contraband rings that the officers were part of. I mean, rings that would bring in $10,000 a week. Yeah. So,
one officer, an inmate, told us about a scheme where they would send hollowed out printers, computer printers, full of cell phones and tobacco, and that would eventually make it its way into the prison.
Wow. This is leading, as we talked with Kenneth Lassiter about, to burnout and people falling asleep, guards falling asleep on the job. I want to talk about that, but I know Elizabeth wants to jump in here. Elizabeth, go ahead.
I did. I just want to address something before we leave the last subject. Family members often get pulled into schemes of extortion, and I've never really figured out how it is accomplished from the inside out, but we have had multiple calls from family members who have been frightened. They have received people inside the prison system. So let's go back to the closed custody issues, because that's really the only communication we really have with closed custody are a few inmates and mainly their family members, and their family members are involved in just keeping their loved ones alive.
Because
remember I said, because of the sentencing grid, you could have somebody that's non-violent crime end up in a maximum facility.
Okay.
That's a shock, okay? And also people with mental health disorders. But extortion is prevalent in closed custody facilities, and many times families will be pulled into that out of fear. And So I believe the way it happens, at least what we've witnessed, is a family member will receive a check. And this in particular family member that we last worked with received a check, a money order, excuse me, for $300.
Okay.
So in turn, that family member has to send that $300 to a designated person.
Where does that money come from?
It comes from inside the prison.
From an inmate or a guard?
We don't know.
Just through the mail or somehow this check, this money order is delivered to a family member.
Order shows up to a family member. The family member is given instructions to double that amount and then obviously other instructions about their loved one if they want to make sure that their loved one is safe.
Okay.
And they will double that amount. Makes no sense to me why they would receive $300 and then have to double it, okay? So, and then they would send that money order to someone else in the state. Not necessarily into the prison, but into the state. They really couldn't send it into the prison.
Does this have the earmarks of gang activity to you?
I'm sure.
And does law enforcement know about this? Outside law enforcement, do they know about it? Do they look into it, the FBI or the State Bureau of Investigation? Are they looking into this? You know about it. They must know about it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The prison's aware of it.
Was this part of your reporting? Did you know about these things?
We've heard stories about similar instances. It's hard to corroborate everything and actually get it in the paper.
Of course. You only have so much newsprint, I suppose. One of the reasons that they're having trouble hiring people, evidently, and I'm sure this is the case across the country, is that most of these prisons are not downtown. They are not in the suburbs. They're in rural areas, and a lot of people don't want to live there. Their spouses can't get jobs there, and that leads to making it very difficult to find people. The state's aware of this, but I would think there would be a great hue and cry if they started building prisons in Ballantyne.
That's true. That's very true. And lawmakers intentionally lobbied to build a lot of these prisons in rural areas because they were seen as economic engines, job generators.
Have they proven to be that?
Well, a lot of people are hired.
Because you got to have food service, got to have linen service, sure. You've got to have guards.
Sure. So there are a lot more jobs in Anson County because Lanesboro's there. But you're exactly right. I mean, the labor pools in these counties are pretty shallow. And then you couple that with the fact that the work is so dangerous, the pay is so low, the work is so demanding. And, you know, it's hard to attract these people. It's hard to hold on to them.
Lanesboro, the prison that you wrote a lot about, is one of the most dangerous prisons within the state, and it's now the largest. And I mentioned earlier that it was going to be there's going to be a name change for the prison. Has that taken place yet?
I think that's in place now, and it's going to be converted to a women's prison.
Yes. Why?
Lanesboro's had a really rocky history, and right now it's more than a third of its officer positions are vacant, or at least that was true in January. And I think there is a lot of concern that things could go haywire there.
So if you're going to convert that prison, a maximum security prison, to a women's prison, you're going to have to send those inmates that are housed there someplace else. Isn't this like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic? Is there any point to this?
A lot of officers have raised exactly that point. They're questioning whether you're just kind of squeezing on the balloon and pushing the problem elsewhere.
And I know that one concern, Elizabeth, that you have about the conversion of Lanesboro to a women's prison has to deal with the fact that the conversion would create hardships for inmates with family members nearby. Not to be crass, but explain to us why we should care about that.
Well, families, from where we stand, mm-hmm. are our greatest and our most economical resource. We have to work better to keep the family nucleus and ties in place with people in the prison system. When you look at prisoners acting out, you know, becoming angry and that type of thing. Prison is an incredibly stressful environment, to say the least. when a family member shows up at the door for visitation, it brings a sense of sanity back, a sense of belonging. So we're very concerned. And no, it's not on the topic of the prison system's concern. It couldn't be. But it's going to impact not only thousands of inmates that are going to be transferred, it's going to impact thousands of family members. For instance, we have a family member that moved lock, stock, and barrel their business, and they sold their home and their family and moved from another state to this state to be next to their loved one.
But I know in the federal system, prisoners get transferred all the time. Is the same not true of the state system? Couldn't that happen whether or not they close the prison or make the prison a women's prison as opposed to a maximum security facility?
Well, prisoners do get transferred all the time for many reasons, but this is a little bit different. This is a mass transfer. We're looking at probably 2, possibly 3,000 people. It's going to include Lanesboro, all three of the female prisons, and they're going to repurpose other prisons.
And the reasons that they've given for doing this are what?
Well, according to staff, NCDPS leadership that we have spoken to just recently, mm-hmm. We had a hunch that one of the reasons was the uptick, if you will, in female offenders, which is sad. So they're really looking down the road to expand room for those female prisoners coming in, getting away from the bad name of Lanesboro, and security.
So as I understand it, when they move these maximum security prisoners, they're going to move them to other smaller prisons, smaller housing units, so they'll get greater supervision. But if you're understaffed within the system itself, can that really happen, or are you making it even more onerous on the guard staff?
I'm curious to see what the staffing at Eastern and Southern, where they're going to move the Lanesboro inmates, how that staffing is going to shake out. Officers that we've talked to said these guys have no idea the type of inmates they're going to get, and they wouldn't be surprised if they see a mass exodus in staff because of them.
Mm. To accomplish your mission at NC Cure, and I'm curious about the name Cure, but to accomplish your mission, you have to build relationships between inmates and prisons and between prisoners and families, etc. How difficult is it to walk the fine line to get the change you seek but not ruffle feathers so that they obstruct your desires?
Right. We've been very lucky and very fortunate. We have a good working relationship with correctional leadership. We have a good relationship with staff. And, you know, for the most part, the majority of prison staff are there. They just want to do their job and go home. But we've been very lucky to go in and sit down at the table with correctional staff and talk through some issues, and they have been addressed, and some of them have been resolved.
So they're listening to you. They are acting. The governor asked for a commission to study best practices. They've done that. They're working on those things. From what you know, from your reporting, from what you know from working with inmates and families in the 15 seconds that we have here, do you think they're on the right track to making significant, helpful changes?
I do, but until they get the staffing that they need, I don't see it improving all that much.
Elizabeth?
I do. I think they're making a concerted effort until they get the funding they need to follow through and address the outcomes.
Ames?
I agree. Staffing is key, and that needs to be addressed before substantial improvements happen.
Ames Alexander and Gavin Off reported in the Charlotte Observer on this prison situation. Elizabeth Forbes is director of NC Cure. Thank all three of you for being here.